Okay, this will be the last message of the sixth message series entitled Spooks Are They For Real? Subtitled Satan, Devil, Demons, and Spirits. And I want you to take note of the fact, you may not remember this six messages back, but I said it was going to be six messages. And lo and behold, it hasn't ended up being 8 or 12 or something else. So you might want to put that down on your calendar. Usually my series end up being a whole lot longer than I initially intend them to be. As a consequence, I have had to deal with some things. You may not think so, but I've had to go over some things rather quickly in some particular areas. But nonetheless, I think we've done the job of discussing the areas that needed to be discussed. At least we will have accomplished that by the time we're done with today's message. In the previous five messages, I addressed the words Satan, devils, and demons as they are found used in the Bible. And as a result, we discovered something altogether different from what is normally preached on those words or subjects from the majority of American pulpits today. Now, admittedly, you may not agree with everything that I've shared with you thus far in this series, and I admit to you that there are some particulars which may be debatable. I'm not saying that everything that I've shared is locked down in concrete. There's very few things that I believe that I would say that about. As far as God's plan of salvation, I don't think anybody can show otherwise in the Scriptures that it teaches other than what I've been sharing for the last nearly 20 years, I guess. That's almost a shocker as I think about that. That means I'm nearing 40. And indeed I am. But anyway, I understand that there are some things, that there may be some intricacies, some angles to what I've shared that I may not have considered yet or looked at that may change the picture some. Which in and of themselves, some particulars that in and of themselves certainly may be able to be interpreted from either position. However, that is not the case when it comes to the teaching that Satan is some fallen angel, which nearly all the other particulars hinge upon. In no fashion can the two Old Testament passages usually used in an attempt to describe Satan as such a creature be construed to teach such a thing. The context of those passages simply will not allow it. The context of those passages have nothing to do with angels, but rather with despotic, false, accusing, devouring lions. Now, if you don't know what I mean by this, I suspect at least you that I'm speaking to in this audience do. But if those in the tape, as they receive this, hear that statement, you don't know what I'm talking about when I make that statement, then you'll have to just wait for the explanation, which will come later in the message. Before doing that, we need to first deal with the Bible's use of the word spirits. Spirits, that is evil spirits, are believed by most of Christendom to be the same thing as demons. For example, in a Christian daily reader that I received from a Christian ministry, under the heading Principalities and Powers, it states this, quote, although they are invisible to us, there does exist a great host of evil spirits organized by the arch-rebel Satan into a vast conspiracy against their Creator as he himself seeks to become the supreme ruler of the cosmos. These are evidently the fallen angels. Very well written, very well said. But I would like someone to provide me such a concise statement as that from the Scriptures. Now, in the New Testament, there are instances where the two words demon and spirits are used interchangeably. So does that mean that spirits are what most people believe demons are? No. It means that they are, at least in those particular instances, the same thing that the Scriptures portray demons as being. In other words, if what we learned about demons in the previous message is true, then the same should pretty much also apply to spirits. For example, if demonology, that is the belief in demons, was demonstrated as being Canaanite mythology, then we should be able to conclude the very same thing about spirits as well. Now, I want you to know, I do not believe that that point in any fashion should be taken lightly. So let me remind you that it is admitted in the Jewish Encyclopedia that Hebrew and Israelite belief in demons or evil spirits was non-existent for the most part prior to the Babylonian captivity. Now, with having said that in last week's message and in this message, someone is probably sure to counter, and already has, by pointing out that in several Old Testament passages, we find prohibitions against what is called familiar spirits. And that's right, we do. Matter of fact, in 16 Old Testament passages to be exact, we find either familiar spirits dealt with or prohibitions given against being involved with them. Prohibitions against the Canaanite practice of familiar spirits. The first time we find the Hebrew word obi translated familiar spirit in the King James Version is in Leviticus 19:31. Let me just read it to you. It says, regard not them that have familiar spirits, neither seek after wizards to be defiled by them. I am Yahweh your God. Now I want you to note two things about this passage. First, note that this admonition was against doing what the Canaanites did. And you say, well, why do you say that? Well, turn with me, if you would, to Leviticus 18. Passage under question. The first time that the term familiar spirits is used in the King James Version, which I just read to you, is in Leviticus 19. But really part of the context, I wouldn't necessarily say the beginning of the context, but part of the context of that passage is Leviticus 18 in verses 1 through 3. Listen carefully. It says, then Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, I am Yahweh your God. You shall not do what is done in the land of Egypt where you lived, nor are you to do what is done in the land of Canaan where I am bringing you. You shall not walk in their statutes. You are to perform my judgments and keep my statutes to live in accord with him. I said verse 3, that was partly the verse 4. But note that in verse 3 it very clearly says there are not to do the things, neither what was done in Egypt, nor what was being or had been done or was being done in the land of Canaan. The same thing. Look at, we'll find that this isn't quite as gapped as far as those two passages, but look at Leviticus. I always say Leviticus, and I've been corrected on that. It's Leviticus. So if I say it again, you just remember it's Leviticus, not Leviticus. Leviticus 20 and verses 23 and 27. Just four verses between these. It says, and when you enter the land and plant all kinds of trees for food, then you... Excuse me, I'm still in 19. 20, chapter 20, verse 23, it says, moreover, you shall not follow the customs of the nation which I shall drive out before you. What nation were they driving out? The Canaanites. For they did all these things, and therefore I have abhorred them. Then jump down to verse 27. It says, now a man or a woman who is a medium or a spiritist shall surely be put to death. They shall be stoned with stones. Their blood guiltness is upon them. And the same thing is found in Deuteronomy 18, 9 through 11 and 14, 2 Kings 21, verses 1 through 6, 2 Chronicles 33, verses 1 through 6. In other words, in every passage where there is a direct prohibition against familiar spirits, we find it is linked with the Canaanite religion. Now, there's other passages that use the term familiar spirits, but in those passages where there is the prohibition against it, it is always linked with the Canaanite religion. In other words, the warning against so doing was not necessarily substantiating the existence of such creatures. You think about that. The warning against being involved with familiar spirits was not necessarily substantiating the existence of such spirits. It could have simply been an admonishment against doing which was a part of the Canaanite religion. Now, also note, when reading Leviticus 19 and verse 31 in the King James Version, it appears to say that these occultic practitioners actually had these spirits. Let me read the first part of 19:31 from the King James Version again. It says, regard not them that have familiar spirits. It appears as if they literally have these spirits. However, according to the original Hebrew text, we find that the New American Standard Version is much more accurate in its translation of this verse. So let me read it from Leviticus 19, or from the New American Standard Version. Leviticus 19, verse 31. It says, do not, listen to the difference. It says, do not turn to mediums or spiritists. Do not seek them out to be defiled by them. I am Yahweh your God. There's quite a bit of difference between the New American Standard and the King James rendition. The Hebrew, which the New American Standard is much more accurate in translating, the Hebrew does not say they had a familiar spirit, but rather that the practitioners were themselves an obi, or a medium, or a necromancer. Does anybody know, is that the right pronunciation for that? Not a term I usually use in my everyday language too much. But anyway, necromancer, or a ventriloquist. That's right. That's how Strong's defines this particular word. It's number 178 in Strong's Concordance, and the word obi is defined in this fashion. From the same as number one, apparently through the idea of prattling a father's name, properly a mumble, that is a water skin from its hollow sound, hence a necromancer, ventriloquist, as from a jar. I think that's rather interesting, that that's how that word is defined, a ventriloquist, somebody who can throw their voice. Now, again, keep in mind that a medium or a spiritist or an obi is one who is supposed to have the dead come back and speak to a person. Now, the question, of course, would maybe be, well, why would God command the Israelites against any involvement in occult practices if they weren't real? Well, as I pointed out in the very first message of this series, through faith, something non-existent can become very real in our minds, through faith. It doesn't have to be real to be real to us. Faith in something non-existent can make it very real. And it's idolatry, whether something is real or not, if someone worships it as if it is real in place of Yahweh. Take idolatry specifically, idols themselves, literal idols, somebody who would literally bow down to an idol. We know that there's nothing to an idol that is any less condemned by God as being something we're not to participate in. Or how about astrology, or palm reading, or tarot cards, or a number of other different things in which we know that there's nothing to them. There's nothing to these practices, but they are still just as much condemned by God. The point being that just because God condemns mediums or witches or whatever doesn't necessarily mean that there's anything to them, except in the minds of those who would give their minds to such practices. Why would he condemn such? Well, because real or not, it is just as much harlotry, just as much harlotry in God's sight. Listen in that light to Leviticus 20 and verse 6. It says, as for the person who turns to mediums, translated having familiar spirits in the King James, but better translated, as for the person who turns to mediums and to spiritists to play the harlot after them, I will also set my face against that person and will cut him off from among his people. Whether those mediums or spiritists actually perform miraculous supernatural feats makes no difference to God's admonition against them, because even if they couldn't, if the people went to them, it's even worse if they couldn't, and they go to them and replace Yahweh by going to them rather than going to Yahweh. Does that make sense? I hope it does. So there's nothing proven of the reality of spirit, evil spirits, by the fact that the Bible deals with familiar spirits in those passages, especially when we see that it's again linked to Canaanite religion. Now, but someone is sure to counter, again, by bringing up the witch of Endor, and as a matter of fact, it already has been brought up. So, we'd better look at the witch of Endor. Let's turn to 1 Samuel chapter 28. 1 Samuel chapter 28, I want to begin with verse 4 and read through verse 15, and pay special pay attention to what this account has to say. Verse 4, it says, "So the Philistines gathered together and came and camped in Shunem, and Saul gathered all Israel together, and they camped at Gilboa. When Saul saw the camp of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart trembled greatly. When Saul inquired of Yahweh, Yahweh did not answer him, either by dreams or by Urim or by the prophets." Now keep in mind that Saul has been rejected at this point by God. Verse 7, "Then Saul said to his servants, 'Seek for me a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her.' And his servants said to him, 'Behold, there is a woman who is a medium at Endor.' Then Saul disguised himself by putting on other clothes and went, he and the two men with him, and they came to the woman by night, and he said, 'Conjure up for me, please, and bring up for me whom I shall name to you.' But the woman said to him, 'Behold, you know what Saul has done, how he has cut off those who are mediums and spiritists from the land. Why are you then laying a snare for my life to bring about my death?' And Saul vowed to her by Yahweh, saying, 'As Yahweh lives, there shall no punishment come upon you for this thing.' Then the woman said, 'Whom shall I bring up for you?' And he said, 'Bring up Samuel for me.' When the woman saw Samuel, she cried out with a loud voice, and the woman spoke to Saul, saying, 'Why have you deceived me? For you are Saul.' And the king said to her, 'Do not be afraid, but what do you see?' And the woman said to Saul, 'I see a divine being coming up out of the earth.' And he said to her, 'What is his form?' And she said, 'An old man is coming up, and he is wrapped with a robe.' And Saul knew that it was Samuel, and he bowed with his face to the ground and did homage. Then Samuel said to Saul, 'Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?'" And of course, the account continues. Now, do you find anything particularly interesting in this account? Well, I do. The woman spiritist was alarmed, nearly terrorized, when her seance actually worked. She was a fake. And she, of all people, knew it. Now, I propose to you that it was God, that God was the one who made this phenomenon to happen, not the witch of Endor or some supernatural spirit. In this light, turn to Isaiah chapter 19 and verse 3. Actually, I flipped right there, so just listen to it as I read it to you. Isaiah 19 and verse 3, it says, "Then the spirit of the Egyptians will be demoralized within them," listen carefully, "and I," it was Yahweh who is here he's speaking of, "and I, Yahweh, will confound their strategy, so that they will resort to idols and ghosts of the dead," is how the New American Standard renders it. Actually, in this case, the King James is much more correct, and it should be charmers. He says, "And I will confound their strategy so that they will resort to idols and charmers and to mediums and spiritists." Mediums, again, being familiar spirits in the King James Version. Notice it was God who confounded them and caused them, in this case, to go to the spiritists, to the mediums. Well, obviously it was the same thing in Saul's case as well. Also consider what's found in Proverbs 16:4. It says, "Yahweh has made everything for its own purpose, even the wicked for the day of evil." And not only has God created the wicked, but listen also to what's found in Isaiah 45, verses 5 through 7. It says, "I am Yahweh, and there is none else. There is no God besides me." Those people who believe in Satan as another god need to take note of what's found here in Isaiah 45. But not only that, it goes on, "I girded thee, though thou hast not known me, that they may know from the rising of the sun and from the west that there is none besides me. I am Yahweh, and there is none else. I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, Yahweh, do all these things." Now, that doesn't fit in with a lot of Christian theology today, but it certainly fits in with what the Bible teaches, and I prefer fitting my theology into the Bible rather than fitting the Bible into my theology. Now, clearly it was Yahweh who made it to happen. Now, if you were to ask most of Christians today, where do evil spirits originate from? They would unanimously declare that they originate or are sent by Satan. Don't you think that's how they would answer? I think you know that's how they'd answer. However, that is not true according to what we find in 1 Samuel 16:4. Turn there, if you would. 1 Samuel 16:4. Let me give you the setting before reading this. Again, Saul at this point has disobeyed God, and God has rejected him as king and sent Samuel to anoint David as king or the future king. 1 Samuel 16, and now let's read verses 14 through 15. It says, "But Samuel said," it says, "Now the Spirit of Yahweh departed from Saul." Listen to what it says. "Now the Spirit of Yahweh departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from Satan," Lucifer, "terrorized him." Is that how your translations read? Well, if you're going to fit the Bible into the current theology of the day, you'd better change your Bible to read that way. It doesn't read that way at all. It says, "Now the Spirit of Yahweh departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from Yahweh terrorized him. Saul's servants then said to him, 'Behold now, an evil spirit from God is terrorizing you.'" An evil spirit from God. That's quite interesting. Again, especially in light of the usual theology about evil spirits and where they come from. There's no question this evil spirit was sent by Yahweh. However, what was the spirit which came upon King Saul here? Was it an evil spirit entity? Well, no. The Hebrew word translated spirits here is never used in the Old Testament in that fashion to describe such creatures. If you do an exhaustive word study of the Hebrew word ruach, R-U-W-A-C-H, you will find that it is clearly just a particular temperament or disposition or possibly the character of a person, good or bad. For example, consider the following passages as examples of good spirits. Deuteronomy 34:9 speaks of a spirit of wisdom. And there it says, "Now Joshua, the son of Nun, was filled with the spirit of wisdom." Psalm 51:10 deals with the spirit of steadfastness. It says, "Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me." Proverbs 11 and verse 13, it says, "A tale-bearer revealeth secrets, but he that is of a faithful spirit concealeth the matter." And Proverbs 17:27 talks of a spirit of coolness. "He who restrains his word has knowledge, and he who has a cool spirit is a man of understanding," as found in the King James Version. Now let me ask you, were any of them, or any of the others I could have used, that was just a small selection of the many different passages I could have used, are any of those going to be interpreted as being individual spirit entities? No, we wouldn't think of doing such a thing. We understand, of course, that these passages are just speaking of particular dispositions or temperaments. Now, is it any different when it comes to what could be called evil spirits in the Old Testament? Well, consider Proverbs 14:23. Talks of a spirit of hastiness. It says, "He that is slow to wrath is of great understanding, but he that is hasty of spirit exalteth folly." The New American Standard Version simply translates the hasty of spirit there as being quick-tempered. And that's probably a pretty good translation, or at least understanding of what's being discussed there as a spirit. Proverbs 16:18 deals with the spirit of haughtiness. It says, "Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before stumbling." Hosea 4:12 talks about a spirit of whoredom. It says, "My people consult their wooden idol, and their diviner's wand informs them. For a spirit of harlotry has led them astray, and they have played the harlot, departing from their God." Now, I think we could say that probably just like in that day and age, we have a spirit of harlotry amongst our people today. Is it an individual spirit that's indwelling our people? I don't think anybody else would conclude that way any more than it was then. Micah 2:11 also talks about a spirit of falsehood. It says, "If a man walking in the spirit and falsehood do lie, saying, 'I will prophesy unto thee of wine and of strong drink,' he shall even be the prophet of this people." Spirit of falsehood. Now, once again, they are just speaking of dispositions, temperaments, or characters of individual people. The New Testament well uses spirit in similar fashion. It speaks of a spirit of poorness, spirit of readiness, vengeance, bondage, a spirit of slumber, meekness, a spirit of fear, of quietness, a spirit of truth, and a spirit of error. Now, are any of those understood to be spirit entities? No, not at all. Again, just temperaments or character. Now, back to the Old Testament. Hopefully, as a result of what I've shared in last week's message on demons and thus far this message on spirits, hopefully you're able to see that the Old Testament doesn't have any more to say about evil spirit entities emanating from Satan than it does about demons. Why? Well, simply because they didn't exist. There is nothing in the Old Testament that deals with the reality of those creatures. It is not to be found in the Old Covenant Scriptures. It was not dealt with as something that was there as a part of the society of that day. It just wasn't there. So, with that, what about the New Testament's use of the word spirits? Well, basically, we did deal with that in last week's message dealing with demons. However, in light of last week's message, let's turn quickly to a passage that's very similar to what we discussed last week, but uses, instead of demons, spirits. Luke chapter 13. Luke chapter 13 and verses 11 through 14, again in light of last week's message, it says, "And he laid his hands upon her," verse 11, "and behold, there was a woman who for 18 years had a sickness caused by a spirit." Does anybody know today of a sickness caused by a spirit? Let's find out what this was. "And she was bent double and could not straighten up at all." She had a problem with her spine. "And when Yeshua saw her, he called her over and said to her, 'Woman, you are freed from your sickness.' And he laid his hands upon her, and immediately she was made erect again and began glorifying God." You know, I can really relate to this particular passage because I got up yesterday morning and had almost the exact same symptoms described of in this particular passage. I could barely walk. I was my spine, my muscles along my spine were pulling me over so that I was crooked, somewhat bent over, both forward and to the side. I couldn't hardly walk without severe pain coming to me. What was it? Was it some spirit that was causing this problem in my being? Was it that there was an evil spirit that needed to be exorcised? No, he was probably already in good shape. Oh, he didn't need to be removed. There wasn't no spirit that needed to be removed. I simply needed to be healed. And I might request some prayers in that regard. I wouldn't mind having this problem that's currently come on me taken care of. I don't think any of you are going to believe that I'm possessed with some evil spirit, and that's why my back is being... Now somebody may come to that conclusion because of what I'm preaching. They're saying, "Well, oh boy, God's doing a deal on you, buddy. You preach against the reality of Satan, and you're just going to get one." You know? Well, I know where my back problem originates from. I broke it in 1973 in a car wreck, and had a disc removed in 1976, and I've got another disc in there that's in bad shape. And something has caused it to flare up. I guarantee it wasn't any evil spirit that's indwelt me that's done it any more than it was a literal evil spirit for this woman as well that caused her physical spinal problem that she had. Now, even though we have basically addressed the New Testament's use of spirits, basically, previously, but let's again examine a few of the more difficult passages in this regard. Matthew chapter 12, and verses 38 through 45 will be the first one I want to address. Matthew chapter 12 and verse 38 says, "Then some of the scribes and Pharisees answered him, saying, 'Teacher, we want to see a sign from you.' But he answered and said to him, 'An evil and adulterous generation craves for a sign, and yet no sign shall be given to it but the sign of Jonah the prophet. For just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the sea monster, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. The men of Nineveh shall stand up with this generation at the judgment and shall condemn it because they repented at the preaching of Jonah. And behold, something greater than Jonah is here. The queen of the south shall rise up with this generation at the judgment and shall condemn it because she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon. And behold, something greater than Solomon is here." And verse 43 it says, "Now when the unclean spirit goes out of a man, it passes through waterless places seeking rest and does not find it. Then it says, I will return to my house from which I came, and when it comes, it finds it unoccupied, swept, and put in order. Then it goes and takes along with it seven other spirits more wicked than itself, and they go in and live there, and the last state of that man becomes worse than the first. That is the way it will also be with this evil generation. Now, verses 43 through 45 are of course the ones under question, where it speaks of one spirit leaving and seven spirits replacing the one. But I want you to take note that Yahshua was using this as an illustration, possibly a parable of the time, to describe something else. Look at the last part of verse 45. Verse 45, it says, in the last part it says, that is the way it will also be with this evil generation. This whole passage is not dealing with evil spirits. It's dealing with evil generations. Look again at the very beginning. It says, verse 39, but he answered and said to them, an evil and adulterous generation craves for a sign. It was simply an illustration to deal with what he was really dealing with. Yahshua was simply illustrating what had taken place since Jonah's generation and the Queen of Sheba's generation and the present generation. That is, that the present generation had become even more evil, maybe seven times more evil than the previous generations, and thus the previous generations, as evil as they were, would still stand up in judgment against the generation of the Pharisees. Very similar, but basically a thought is provided to us in Matthew 23:15 when it says, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you travel about on land and sea and make one proselyte, and when he becomes one, you make him twice the sons of hell as yourselves. That could be describing our generation. Maybe a parable or an illustration could be used of one and two spirits. Because I really believe the proselytes, the Khazars that we have today, are twice the sons of hell of the Pharisees of Yeshua's day, who were probably at least part, if not all, Judahites. You see the point? The point is that Yeshua was simply using that as an illustration, not about evil spirits, but about evil generations. So, that takes care of that one. Let's go to Acts chapter 16 for the next one. Acts 16, verses 16 through 18. It says, and it happened that as we were going to the place of prayer, a certain slave girl, having a spirit of divination, met us, who was bringing her masters much profit by fortune-telling. Following after Paul and us, she kept crying out, saying, these men are bondservants of the Most High God who are proclaiming to you the way of salvation. Note here that it was she who was calling out, not in this case, it is not defined as some demon or spirit that's calling out. And she continued doing this for many days, but Paul was greatly annoyed and turned and said to the Spirit, I command you in the name of Yeshua the Christ to come out of her, and it came out at that very moment. Now, someone is sure to ask, if the exorcism of spirits is simply the healing of certain physical infirmities, then where is the infirmity in this particular case? Well, some possible light is shed on this situation by an examination of some of the Greek words translated in this particular, or used in this particular passage. For example, the word divination is number 4436 in Strong's Concordance. It's the Greek word puthon. It comes from, as defined by Strong's, from Putho, the region where Delphi, the seat of the famous oracle, was located, a python, that is, by analogy with the supposed diviner. The word fortune-telling is number 3132. It's the Greek word manthume, and it is defined as from 3105, to divine, that is, utter spells under pretense of fortune-telling. It said it comes from number 3105. Number 3105 is a very similar word. It's manome, and it simply is defined as to rave as a maniac. So, from the Greek, we have at least the possibility of another case similar to the one of the man with possessed with a legion of demons, quote-unquote. That is a possible case of mental dementia of some kind. At least a possibility. Going on. 1 Corinthians chapter 12 will be the next one. In verse 10, we find this. It says, in another, the effecting of miracles, or let's start up a little bit before that. It says, verse 8, it says, For to one is given the word of wisdom through the Spirit, and to another the word of knowledge according to the same Spirit, to another faith by the same Spirit, and to another gifts of healing by one Spirit, and to another the effecting of miracles, and to another prophecy, and to another, the distinguishing of spirits, to another various kinds of tongues, and to another interpretation of tongues. One of the first century miraculous gifts of the Holy Spirit was the distinguishing of spirits. The word distinguishing is the Greek word, comes from the Greek word diakaisis, and it simply is defined as judicial estimation. Now don't misunderstand me in this particular case. I do not believe it was simply judicial estimation, but that it was miraculous judicial estimation. There's no question that the gifts that are listed here for this first century situation were miraculous gifts that God had given them and blessed them with at that particular time to perform in a miraculous fashion. It was the miraculous ability to judge the character of an individual. But it's a spirit here. Now, I'm telling you, I believe it was the individual. Matter of fact, I believe Peter obviously had this very same gift. Turn with me to Acts chapter 15. I believe it proves that the Spirit, the interpretation of the Spirit was the interpretation of, the distinguishing of the Spirit was the distinguishing of the judicial estimation of their character, their temperament, or their disposition. And I believe that Acts 15 proves my case. Acts 5. In verses 1 through 4, we find the account again of Ananias and Sapphira. It says, "But a certain man named Ananias with his wife Sapphira sold a piece of property and kept back some of the price for himself with his wife's full knowledge. And bringing a portion of it, he laid it at the apostles' feet. But Peter said, Ananias, why has Satan filled your heart to lie to the Holy Spirit and to keep back some of the price of the land? While it remained unsold, did it not remain your own? And while it was sold, was it not under your control? Why is it that you have conceived this deed in your heart? You have not lied to men, but to God." And as he heard these words, Ananias fell down and breathed his last, and great fear came upon all who heard it. Now, do you recall who Satan, the adversary in this particular passage, is identified as being? Identified as being Ananias, or his deceitful heart, isn't it? Verse 3, it says that Satan, the adversary, filled his heart. Then in verse 4, but in verse 4 it says, "You," speaking to Ananias, "you have conceived this deed in your heart." So let's keep that in mind right off the bat, that we're not talking about, again, some fallen angel that caused this to happen. The Satan, the adversary, is defined by the passage itself as being Ananias himself, or at least his sinful human nature. Now, was it an evil spirit that possessed Ananias that Peter discerned here? It was obviously a miraculous discerning that was taking place. Was it an evil spirit that Peter discerned here that possessed Ananias? Well, had it been such, Peter would have cast it out. Instead, Peter discerned Ananias' spirit, or his character, or his heart. And rather than casting out a demon, Ananias was judged and was struck down. We find a very similar situation with Simon the sorcerer in Acts chapter 8, where we find these words. It says, "But Peter said to him, May your silver perish with you, because you thought you could obtain the gift of God with money. You have no part or portion in this matter, for your heart is not right before God. Therefore repent of this wickedness of yours, and pray the Lord that if possible the intention of your heart may be forgiven you, for I see that you are in the gall of bitterness and the bondage of iniquity." It wasn't the bondage of a fallen angel, a demon of darkness. He was in the bondage of iniquity which came from his heart. Peter discerned it again as being that. It was the gift, the miraculous gift of the discerning of spirits, the discerning of temperaments, the discerning of dispositions, the discerning of character of people. It's too bad that those who claim to have it in this day and age couldn't do as well when it came to Jimmy and Tammy Baker and Baker. You know, they should have been able to discern what these people were really up to. Had they been able to discern not a demon who possessed their bodies, but had they been able to discern the character of such people, the disposition of such people. Okay, let's go to the next one. 1 Timothy chapter 4. First Timothy 4 and verse 1, it says, "But the Spirit explicitly says that in later times some will fall away from the faith, paying attention to deceitful spirits and doctrines of demons." And note that they will fall away from the faith, paying attention to deceitful spirits and doctrine of demons. Now, what does Paul identify these deceitful spirits and demons as being? I don't want you to wait for me to identify them. What does Paul identify them as being? The hypocrisy of liars. Look at verse 2. It says, "By means of the hypocrisy of liars seared in their own conscience as with a branding iron." Paul identifies them as the hypocrisy of liars. Liars who are not possessed by demons, but liars who are seared in their own conscience. Now compare 1 Timothy 4 and verse 1 and 2, what we find there, with what we find in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 14. Ephesians 4, verse 14, where it says, "As a result, we are no longer to be children tossed here and there by waves and carried about by every wind of doctrine, by the trickery of men, by craftiness in deceitful scheming." First note the phrases in Ephesians 4. The phrase is wind of doctrine, trickery of men, and deceitful scheming. Let me dilute that down. We just say that it's talking about the deceitful, windy doctrines of men. Okay? 1 Timothy 4:1 speaks of deceitful spirits and doctrine of demons. Or put another one, deceitful doctrines of spirits. Now, the word doctrine and deceitful in both 1 Timothy 4 and Ephesians 4 are the same Greek words used in both places. The word spirit in 1 Timothy 4 is from the Greek word pneuma. And its the primary definition of this word is, quote from Strong's Concordance, "a current of air, that is breath, blast, or a breeze," end quote. That's the primary. It talks about doctrine of spirits, or deceitful spirits. And Ephesians 4 talked about the wind of doctrine, by every wind of doctrine. Well, spirits, the primary meaning is very similar. It's not the same word, but it's very similar. The word means a wind or a spirit or a breath or a blast. Very similar. In other words, what Paul identifies as deceitful spirits and doctrine of demons in 1 Timothy 4, by the language that's used in both places, he identifies in nearly identical language as the deceitful, windy doctrines of scheming, crafty, false teachers in Ephesians 4. Now, I believe this really puts the cap on that. That may have been a little bit hard to follow, but if you go back and you examine those words in the Greek, you'll find that they're both dealing with the very same thing. But here is really the capstone to what I'm sharing with you. In 1 John, consider 1 John 4. In verses 1 through 3, where it says this, "Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are from God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world. By this you know the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesses that Yeshua the Christ has come in the flesh is from God, but every spirit that does not confess Yeshua is not from God, and this is the spirit of the Antichrist." Now let me just ask you, is there any question as to who the spirits are in verses 2 and 3? Was it spirits who were either confessing Yeshua or not confessing Yeshua? No, we recognize the spirits there as being individual people. That it was them who were either confessing Yeshua or not. Consequently, we can also conclude that the spirit in verse 1 are the spirits, I should say, in verse 1, are the false prophets in verse 1. Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are from God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world. You see, 1 John makes it very clear that the spirits that we need to be aware of that Paul deals with in 1 Timothy chapter 4 and in Ephesians 4, the spirits that we need to be aware of are simply the false prophets. Now, there is something else that's extremely interesting, at least as a possibility, about the passage of 1 Timothy 4. The word of, in the phrase, doctrine of demons, could have possibly just as accurately been translated about. Samuel Green's Grammar of New Testament Greek, in dealing with adjectives in a genitive case, confirms that the phrase doctrine of demons could be rendered, quote, teachings in respect of demons, end quote. That is, about demons. Now, listen to verse 1 with the word about used in place of the word of. 1 Timothy 4:1 would read this way: But the Spirit explicitly says that in later times some will fall away from the faith, paying attention to deceitful spirits and doctrines about demons. Now, if that was Paul's intent in this passage, that would be the clincher regarding the false concepts about demonology. And I think probably be the clincher about the false concept of spirits, the false concept of devils, and the false concepts that are so prevalent today in the religious world about Satan. Well, there's no question that no matter how you view Satan, devils, demons, and spirits, the normally accepted and taught doctrine concerning these words has diverted most of Christendom from effectively being the salt of the earth and from engaging the enemies of Christianity, the Antichrist, who are in our midst today. I don't think anyone can disagree with that. Of course, there may be some. But if indeed this doctrine of Satan, even if, I was going to say, prevalent doctrine about Satan is untrue, but even more so, if it's true, I would think people would have to admit that it still keeps people from dealing effectively with the problems, with the enemies of Christianity in our midst today. I just can't see anyone not admitting that. I received a letter this past week from a brother who didn't agree with everything that I'd shared, with what he had heard thus far in this series. However, he still wrote the following. Quoting from his letter, he wrote this. He said, "Also it occurred to me that the quote-unquote Satan, most familiar to the church world, is more powerful in their schemes of things than Yahweh. Yahweh commands and even pleads with us to follow him, all too often with little or no result. While Satan has a much easier time with us, we do his will without even trying or thinking about it. Satan expends hardly any effort at all in having us carried out his plans, and thus, at least on the surface, it would appear that Satan is mightier than the God they claim to worship." And he goes on, he says, "Finally, one of the big problems I have with the Satan doctrine as currently taught by Christendom is that it has the effect of fostering irresponsibility. I can't tell you the number of times I've brought up injustices or pointed out ungodly practices or situations to Christians, only to have them chalk it all up to the devil, while the perpetrator, in parentheses the human one, doesn't even get a scolding, but rather has all the Christians lining up to make excuses for him. He's only human, subject to the temptations of the devil, etc. You're right in one thing, and that is that we have got to start holding ourselves and others responsible for sin, and stop trying to find a horned, red-suited, pitchfork-carrying scapegoat to blame it all on." End of quote from this brother's letter. Said it very well. Again, he didn't, at this point, agree with my basic premise about Satan and the devil. But he still had to admit that it's keeping our focus away from the real problems that are facing American Christianity today. You know, here's a classic case of just how ridiculous it is to accuse the devil or demons for our own sins and failings. I think I've read this to you probably in a previous message, but it's so good I want to use it again. It's an article or a editorial out of the Milwaukee Sentinel, January 11th, 1989, entitled "Bakers Have Found the Perfect Excuse." Let me read it to you again. It says, "At last, Jim and Tammy Faye Baker have come clean. Jimmy Baker still looking like an aging Campbell's soup kid, and his wife Tammy Faye still bearing a striking resemblance to Mrs. Potato Head, are back on the airwaves with a scaled-down version of their old PTL Club television show and offering a bold explanation for all that has gone wrong with their lives in the last couple of years. It's simple," Jim Baker declared on their premiere show. "The devil made them do it." "The devil, you say?" "Yep, the devil. Old Lucifer, El Diablo, old Nick, the bad man. The devil simply got jealous of the nice, beautiful, wonderful, multi-million-dollar empire the Bakers had built here on Earth with their viewers' donations, and the devil felt compelled, dishonor-bound, you might say, to do something about it," Baker said. "Quote, I think the devil was mad," end of quote, Baker explained. Quote, "The devil said, this is it. I got to smash Jim and Tammy," end of quote. Well, that sure clears things up, doesn't it? Now we know who put young Jessica, I'm not a bimbo, Han into Jim Baker's clutches in a hotel room. It was the devil. Now we know what made Baker resign and turn his multi-million-dollar ministry over to Moral Majority founder Jerry Falwell. It was the old devil, the devil. Now we know why Falwell turned on Baker, took PTL to bankruptcy court, and alleged that Baker was a homosexual. What a devilish thing to do. But what else can you expect from the devil? That naughty devil. And who, pray tell, is really responsible for Baker's indictment on 24 counts of criminal fraud for the way he raised and spent money on PTL? As the church lady of Saturday Night Live would say, could it be Satan? I sympathize with the Bakers. The devil bedevils many of our lives. When I was 6 or 7, I remember how the devil knocked over one of my mother's favorite pieces of china while I innocently was engaged in a serious work of ramming a toy truck into the base of her china cabinet. When Mom asked what happened, I reported what the devil had done. Unfortunately, she remained unconvinced. "The devil didn't do it, you did," she said, proceeding to swat the devil out of my backside. Somehow, I bet Jim Baker had a more trusting mother when he was a kid, or at least a more convincing set of excuses. I bet little Jimmy Baker would have stood up proudly, looked his mom square in the eye and said, "You know what happened, Mom? I'll bet the devil looked at that wonderful, beautiful things that we have in this house, and he grew jealous." "Yeah, that's what happened, Mom. I think the devil was mad. The devil said, this is it. I've got to smash that warm, loving relationship Jim has with his wonderful, kind, and gentle mother." After all, Jim Baker's mom probably smiled, patted him on the head, and said something soothing like, "That's okay, son. You're a good boy. Now take your Bible and pick up your collection plate and run along and play with the other children. Here's a bright new shiny dime just to get you started." I'm not putting it down, mind you. I'm just wondering why others haven't used it. Imagine Richard Nixon, for example, pleading, "I'm not a crook, the devil may be." End of quote of this article. How well that was stated, and how foolish it makes those who want to try to blame their own sins and shortcomings and failings upon the devil or demons. Now, I have dealt with 1 Peter 5, 8, and 9 in other messages, but this would be an incomplete series without doing it again. I'm about out of time, so I'm going to have to do this very quickly. 1 Peter 5, in verses 8 and 9, is where we find these words. It says, "Be of sober spirit, be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls about like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. But resist him firm in your faith, knowing that the same experiences of sufferings are being accomplished by your brethren in the world." Now, when most of the people today would read that passage, they immediately would think that Peter is apprising Christians to beware of and resist Satan. However, this conclusion is arrived at simply because the translators once again failed to translate one of the words in this passage, the word devil. Now, had the translators translated this word, it would have been rendered as slanderer or false accuser. The word translated adversary in verse 8 literally means an opponent at law. And this false accusing adversary at law is also described as a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. Now, letting the Bible be its own best commentary, who or what else is describing the Bible as a devouring, roaring lion? Well, Jeremiah provides us the answer, as you all know. Jeremiah 50 and verse 17 once again says, Israel's a scattered flock. The lions have driven them away. The first one who devoured him was the king of Assyria, and this last one who has broken his bones is Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. And then in 51 and verse 38, he says, they will roar together like young lions, roaring, devouring lions. In other words, despotic, oppressive, tyrannical rulers were designated as such by the prophet Jeremiah. So now we know that Peter, according to the Bible, is also describing a despotic tyrant who falsely accused and opposed Christians at law. Who was it? None other than Nero, who opposed Christians at law, who devoured, murdered them by the hundreds, maybe thousands, and who falsely accused them of burning down Rome and who knows what else. It wasn't some demon of darkness that Peter was warning Christians about. It was the despotic ruler Nero. And that's also why I said at the beginning of this message that the two Old Testament passages usually used in an attempt to describe Satan as a fallen angel are simply despotic rulers, is describing despotic rulers as roaring lions. Hopefully now you can see why just this one doctrine has diverted our attention from being effective soldiers for Christ here on earth. The common Satan-devil doctrine has become a scapegoat for our people. The devil made me do it. But what's especially interesting about this is that Yeshua is supposed to be our scapegoat, not Satan. The use of the word scapegoat in the English language originates from the Israelite practice found in Leviticus chapter 16, wherein the Israelites took two goats, one which they sacrificed and the other the scapegoat which they sent into the wilderness with their sins. Both goats were types of Yeshua the Christ. One represented his sacrifice and the other, the scapegoat, represented the removal of our sins. You see, really, it's your choice. Either you can choose the false, fake God, Lucifer, Satan, as your God or your scapegoat as an excuse for your sins, or you may choose Yahweh Yeshua as your scapegoat who removes your sin. It's your choice. Let me conclude this message with this ancient anonymous prayer. From the cowardice that shrinks from new truth, from the laziness that is content with half-truths, from the arrogance that thinks it knows all truth, O God.